Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a Damn Interesting Week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link. All right. From Atlas Obscura, the vibes are on brand for this early new year because we have just discovered how the world's oldest anus has an unexplained glow in Florida.
Glow? Mm. Okay.
Yeah, there are a lot of keywords in there, so we'll unpack it all. But we are going to the water to explore some amazing sea life, and we will start with meeting a Ben Brandao, who remembers his first official introduction to comb jellies. They're really beautiful. They kind of look like jellyfish, and they do have bioluminescent features. But back in 2017, Ben was running kayaking tours in Cape Canaveral, Florida. Now, in late October that year, two buses full of geneticists pulled up at the shore to join his tour.
Party buses.
Two buses of geneticists. I know the whole thing sounds like a run-up for a joke, but they had come from Europe for a genetics conference in Orlando, and they were super excited. They kept asking, are we going to see comb jellies? We really want to see comb jellies. Yeah. And comb jellies are some of the creatures that can emit bioluminescence, especially if they're agitated in water splashed by paddles or even hands. But other organisms here glow in the same manner. So Ben was like, why are these scientists pinpointing the comb jelly? Well, as it turns out, geneticists study comb jellies because they are among the oldest living beings on Earth. And as such, they carry some of the oldest genes on the planet. But about a year before Ben's geneticists came to visit him on the tour, the creatures made a splash in the scientific world for an entirely different reason. Their pooping process.
Hmm.
They shocked scientists with their number two tricks in 2016 when evolutionary biologist William Brown showed videos of them defecating at a conference in St. Augustine, Florida. So until then, scientists thought that comb jellies ate and excreted through the same opening, kind of like most other simple organisms. But Brown's video showed that they had a mouth in addition to an anus, which meant they had evolved the so-called through gut, in which food comes in through the mouth and then comes out the other end. Now, this revelation was such a big deal that it merited publication in the journal Science, which stated that, and I cannot emphasize enough, this is a quote from the article, the butthole is one of the finest innovations in the past 540 million years of animal evolution, end quote.
I mean, he's not wrong. I don't disagree.
Exactly, because doing so made eating not only more efficient, but more hygienic.
Mm-hmm.
This finding propelled the creature to evolutionary stardom, which is what would bring two busloads of geneticists to a tour. So once he figured this out and heard all about this, well, he too became hooked and became comb jelly's number one fan, completely fascinated by them. As he is quoted, affectionately remarking, they are voracious eaters. They literally eat nonstop, anything they can find. Because yeah, having an excreting orifice may have also allowed these creatures to spend more time eating. Because when you don't have that hole occupied with poop, and well, you can just shove more in there, right?
Right, just keep the train going.
That's exactly it. And in 2020, when the COVID pandemic hit, Ben was back in his hometown of St. Augustine. He had formed his own company by then called GeoTrippin, and he was running kayak tours on Guana Lake, a tidal estuary between St. Augustine and Jacksonville, when he made a discovery. He was on a sunset tour, and he spotted walnut comb jellies, and it was after dark, so they were kind of twinkling in the water as he paddled, which generally organisms produce bioluminescence only at certain times of the year, because the salinity of the water and the temperature has to be just right for it to occur. And finally, after months of seeing them flickering regularly, he realized this was happening in the lake year-round. So they attracted local researchers from the University of Florida who came to join his tours to investigate the occurrence. Now, humans and comb jellies, we actually share quite a few genes. One recent study found that comb jellies are distantly related to all other animals on Earth.
Hmm.
So scientists are now studying them to understand what roles different genes play in an organism. So effectively, if a gene persisted through millions of years of evolution, you get a better idea of how important a gene might be because it's been around for a longer period of time. So do we have comb jellies to thank for our own anus genes? Maybe.
Maybe.
We still don't know for sure, but we do share that capability with them, and scientists are hoping to find out more. And meanwhile, the fact that comb jellies possess the world's most ancient anus makes Ben's Twilight tours a very popular attraction.
Yeah, I mean, it clearly has made money for him as well.
Mm-hmm. To all those suffering from hemorrhoids, I'm sorry to have made you think about your butt last few minutes.
Sorry. I forgot that content warning there, but I'm sure we could add it in.
Right.
All right. Next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from BBC. It's titled Stares and Ear Twitches, The Linguist Learning to Speak the Expressive Language of Cows.
Aww.
Yeah. So Leoni Cornips was long overdue for her coffee break, but Cornips was busy. She was a couple of hours into her work with a small herd of dairy cows. And if she left right now, she would lose something she calls the rhythm of the cow. Cornips is a sociolinguist at the Meertens Institute in Amsterdam in the Netherlands. The soft-spoken researcher earned her academic laurels in the 1990s, and she still studies variations in syntax between different dialects in the Netherlands. But in addition to this, Cornips' work has more recently taken what professionals in the field call the animal turn, which apparently is such a frequent thing that they literally, there's a link to a study discussing the animal turn in linguistics here.
Whoa!
I guess it makes sense, you know, eventually you hit the limit of human language and then you're like, let me see what the animals
are
up to.
That's right, what else is out there?
Yeah. So for years, Cornips has spent her summer holidays on a farm. She was struck from the start by the different personalities of individual cows, and she felt that cows had the intelligence and social habits to be good research subjects for a linguist. As a Dutch person, she also knew they were cultural icons in a nation with a passion for cheese. So she turned her professional skills to cows.
Smart.
Yeah, humans have assumed for centuries that the ability to use language is a measure of our superiority. There's even an academic term for it, logocentrism, meaning those who use words occupy a privileged position. But Cornips is using her work with dairy cows to push back on this idea. It extends half a century of effort that began with Jane Goodall's work with chimpanzees and Roger Payne's recording of humpback whales in the 1960s in an effort to show that humans may not be as linguistically unique as we had assumed. But most research on cow language tends to focus on sounds. A 2015 study in the Netherlands, for example, looked at the pitch of cow sounds to see if they correlated with behaviors, and a 2019 Australian study found cows not only have distinctive individual vocalizations, but maintain these distinctive calls across a variety of contexts.
Ooh.
Cornips and the farmers she recruits to assist her record the frequency, duration, and intensity of the sounds cows make, but she also focuses on the other ways meaning is expressed among bovines. Her methods are often ethnographic, a way of studying cultures that relies strongly on observation by the researcher. She says, I notice with cows that the body is an instrument to get to know the other. Recognizing this leads Cornips to talk less of language and more widely of languaging practices.
Hmm.
Cows, for example, have an elaborate greeting ritual that Cornips must follow to successfully slip into the rhythm of the herd, she says. This became obvious with Piet, a young male Fleckvi cow from an intensively managed indoor facility who Cornips brought to join five other cows in an outdoor pasture. Cornips says, I was always so happy to see him that when I got into his meadow, I walked straight towards him and tried to touch him immediately. And when she did so, Piet would back away. Cornips gradually came to understand the need to respect Piet's personal space as she might with a fellow human.
Aww.
She learned to keep her arms by her sides and only use eye contact intermittently, taking turns with Piet to look at each other and then look away.
And she had to do the truffle shuffle.
Yeah.
But I like that they're exploring this nonverbal communication with animals because the whole like setup and premise was like, clearly they're not communicating if they're not using vocal language. Right, guys?
Yeah. And Cornips says, it took me quite a while. I was very stupid. They're teaching me how to connect to them.
Mm-hmm.
She realized she had to learn an etiquette, and without patience and attention, you would never see it. Patience also turns out to be crucial when cows communicate with each other. When a mother calls her calf, it sometimes takes 60 seconds for the calf to respond. The space between is filled with bodily gestures. Studies from Austria show that ear positioning and neck stretching are integral to cow language. Humans think of the ability to wiggle our ears as a party trick, but for a cow, it appears to be fundamental to communication. And as we discussed last week, Jen is a shoo-in for cow communication.
Hey, I'm ready to go, y'all.
Yes. So, one difference between humans and many animals is their use of the environment. Cornips has found cow communication leans on its surroundings more than ours. She observed one herd where individuals use their bodies to bang on an iron fence to communicate with the rest of the herd at feeding time, which she views as a type of language.
Mm-hmm. It's like the supper's on with
the cowbell.
Cornips is shocked by how readily people assume cows are stupid. She says, in becoming a dairy cow, they must have very rich communicative skills because they have to understand what the farmer wants them to do, which is not easy. Cornips has analyzed recordings to show that cows will simplify their vocalization once a farmer recognizes their need. Rather than having their intelligence bred out of them to be more compliant, Cornips thinks domestic animals are forced to develop a fuller communication repertoire than wild animals. Animals use sound completely differently from how humans use it, she says. If we're to do a good job at understanding how animals are communicating and why they are communicating, it behooves us to adopt their perspective. And yeah, the hoof, you know, yeah. Anyway, so the answers to these questions could change how we regard the lives of many animals. When 96% of the weight of mammals on Earth is made up of humans and domesticated livestock, which is an insane number, I did not realize that was the case. Understanding better what cattle, sheep, and chickens are communicating could lead to improved relationships with them, as well as better lives for animals. Cornips knows things are unlikely to change fast. Recently, though, she has noticed the idea that animals have language has become more common in academic journals. She hopes linguistics can be a tool for unlocking different attitudes. She says, my most important goal is to show others that you can look with different eyes at a domestic animal.
And depending on how you look at them, they might think you're saying something.
That's right. Yeah, don't give them the stink eye. Just give them a gentle gaze and see what you get back.
And here in the West, that happened fairly quickly with dogs, right?
Mm-hmm,
so
yeah.
All of 50 years ago, you did not have your dogs inside.
Right.
Yeah.
They were totally foreign.
And now they're family members. So.
Mm-hmm.
I know, right? Yeah. And now they take up more space on the bed.
Right.
Next link.
Next link.
Okay, this comes from Popular Mechanics, a bit hyperbolic, but scientists just created a, quote, new type of matter.
Ooh.
And also, according to Popular Mechanics, chainmail is having a bit of a moment. Last month, a team of scientists led by Northwestern University developed molecular chainmail made of mechanical polymer bonds.
Okay.
Not to be outdone, another team of scientists at Caltech has developed a not quite liquid, not quite solid form of matter called polycatenated architected materials, known as PAMs.
Well, that rolls off the tongue a lot better. Okay.
Right, yeah. Because this material isn't fully crystalline like a solid or fully granule like a liquid, it can maintain the advantage of both, meaning it can respond to a wider range of stress. This could have big implications for protective materials like helmets and padding, as well as biomechanical stuff and scary robotics.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right, this is a little bit cautionary here with how Popular Mechanics wrote this next sentence. Quote, PAMs are really a new type of matter. Solid materials are often described as crystalline lattices. ... These materials are made up of discrete particles, free to move and slide relative to one another. And I thought to myself, wait, what? That sentence doesn't make sense. So I clicked on the actual press statement, and here's the full sentence. This is what we see in the classic ball and stick models of atomic and chemical and larger crystalline structures. So those are the solid materials. It is these materials that have formed our conventional understanding of solid matter. The other class of materials is granular, as we see in substances like rice, flour, and ground coffee. These materials are made up of discrete particles free to move and slide relative to one another. So he just squish those two sentences together to make it seem like the crystalline lattices are free to move and slide relative to one another.
Right.
And that was not the case. Like, be careful, popular mechanics, and how you write that.
Mm-hmm.
So that being said, although these new materials are highly technical, they look very fun to play with. These PAMs come in all shapes and sizes, but for this study, the team created cube and sphere-like structures with roughly 2-inch diameters. One of the doctors said, "I was a chemist and I wanted to make these structures at a molecular level, but that proved too challenging. In order to get answers to the questions I had about these structures, I decided to join the group and study PAMs at larger scales." So these things, it looks like 3D chainmail, like somebody just made a mesh of chainmail out of plastics.
Okay.
So to design the structures, the team modeled them on a computer and mostly recreated a crystalline structure. But instead of using the fixed particles, they replaced them with entangled rings or cages with multiple sides. So they have a lot less friction. And the team tested this, quote, new form of matter, which I think is a bit hyperbolic, under a variety of different stressors. "We started with compression," said the lead author, "compressing the objects a bit harder each time. Then we tried to shear with lateral force. And finally, we did a rheology test, seeing how the materials respond to twisting. When they twist like water. So you can actually twist them because the chains will move.
Mm-hmm.
But when you squish them, they actually will kind of lock into place."
Hmm.
Scientists are just now starting to grapple with the possibilities of what to do with this stuff other than just play with it in their hands.
Right.
But due to their unique structure, they're particularly adept at dispersing energy.
Mm.
Because each element can slide and rotate and reorganize relative to each other.
They're crumple zones.
Mm-hmm. So we've known about chainmail for 2,000 years. And now for the first time, which to me is remarkable, we're trying 3D chainmail in shapes with plastic 3D printed stuff. I guess we can 3D print that stuff a lot easier now.
Than we could in the Middle Ages? Yeah, I think so, probably.
Yeah, or just even a few years ago, trying to link all those pieces together in a 3D scale would be kind of a nightmare to do. But we'll see what they do with them. Probably just arm the future robots so we can't shoot them or take them down.
I mean, don't underestimate the market value of a good fidget toy. Like, I feel like you could make a lot of money and then use that to research whatever real uses you want if you just make little squishy balls everybody can play with at their desk.
Fair, fair. I bet probably you're right. That's going to be the first commercial application is just a toy.
Everyone's going to have one, you guys. Do you have
one? That's right.
You're behind
the times. More microplastics in the bloodstream. Let's go.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's plastics and little metals in there. So it's
heavy metals, also great for the human body.
Bonus.
Yeah.
Bonus. All right, next link.
Next link.
All right. Next up, we've got a little explainer video from CGP Grey called "The Hidden Pattern in Postcodes." And yes, one of the very first things they note is that the rest of the world does call them postcodes, and only America and weirdly the Philippines call them zip codes. And this is because in America, the concept was first introduced as the Zone Improvement Plan.
Oh.
Yeah.
I assumed because it was like zippy.
Well, it was intentionally chosen so that it could be abbreviated as zip. And that's because they anticipated correctly that American customers do not like change. And they wanted this new requirement to be positively associated with the promise that the mail would travel faster to its destination. So, yes, you are right. But they sort of went backwards from that.
Like, if they had launched this in the 80s, they would have been rad codes.
Probably, yes. Gnarly mail, y'all. In any case, while every country's postcode system is slightly different, they all follow the same basic idea, which is that the digits slowly narrow down from left to right the location that they're meant for. So, for example, in the United States, we use a 5-digit zip code, which sometimes has 4 extra numbers at the end, but we're going to get to that. And that first number represents one of 10 large areas that the U.S. has been somewhat arbitrarily carved into. So if your zip code starts with 0, for example, you are part of the Greater Atlantia region, which includes all of the New England states, plus New Jersey, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. And already we can see that this doesn't make a lot of sense, right? Because Puerto Rico is way down south, so why wouldn't it be included in one of those closer regions? And the answer to that question is a theme that comes up a lot in this video, which is that this system is not actually very flexible or good, And it has had to be amended many times over the years as territories were added and populations fluctuated in different areas unexpectedly. And so what started out as a very logical division of the country is now a complete and total mess. So, you know, then the second digit, not surprisingly, divides each of these regions into 10 smaller ones and so on. But it's also important to realize that there are large swaths of the country that do not have a zip code at all because no one lives there.
Right? Oh, okay.
And again, this means that if someone does move there, all of the numbers are already taken. So they're going to have to be lumped in with something nearby. Except if all of the codes touching that new area are already highly populated cities, then it's probably going to get attached to something much farther away instead, the same way Puerto Rico was. So it just gets messier and messier over time. But it's also really hard to fix because they already know, just like they did in the very beginning, that people hate having their address changed, which I can understand. I've actually had that happen to me. Have y'all ever had your zip code changed?
Mm-mm. No.
Yeah, I was living in this house and the city was just like, by the way, your zip code is different now. And it was a massive pain because this was in the old days. We were like, oh, so we have to contact every magazine and every bill that we pay and tell them to update us or else we're just not going to get our mail anymore, is what you're saying. And they were like, yeah, pretty much.
Hmm.
And so people's hatred of this experience was proven yet again when the Zip Plus 4 system was introduced all the way back in 1983, which I had no idea it had been around that long. And people still don't want to use it to this very day. Which you actually should, by the way, because it turns out that mail with the full 9 digits in the zip code gets priority sorting at the post office and will definitely arrive at its destination faster.
Shh, wait, we're going to cut that part out, right? And just leave that for us.
But that brings us to another problem with the zip code system, right? Which is that this whole thing was originally designed for human mail sorters, and that just doesn't happen anymore until the very, very end of the line. For most of its journey these days, mail is sorted by machines, which actually have to work harder to figure out that weird street name you wrote in your really terrible handwriting. And in fact, if we could convince people to do it, it would be much more efficient to just label all our mail with GPS coordinates. And, you know, that might sound a little extreme and hard to remember, but it's actually more doable than it sounds. And we know that because in 2015, the Republic of Ireland basically did it.
Whoa.
Yeah. And their case was admittedly a little unique in that Ireland had persisted with an extremely outdated system for far too long, which was made worse by the fact that fully 35% of buildings in Ireland do not have specific numbers or names attached to them.
Whoa.
Yeah. And so up until 2015, the mail carriers in Ireland just had to personally know where the O'Reillys lived. Like, oh, it's the greenhouse. Like, that's the best you were going to get.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, of course, ridiculously hard. But what it meant was that by the time Ireland finally instituted a postcode system, computers were very much a thing. And by using both letters and numbers, they were able to design a system that translated GPS coordinates directly into a 4-digit code. But here's the key. They assigned the translation of those codes randomly. Your code has nothing to do with the code of the person next door. And when a new house is built, they can just spit out a new code without having to worry about whether it fits in sequentially with the street or the region or anything else.
Who needs context?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like how Amazon does their stocking, right? Like, you've heard of that it just goes to a random spot, but the computer knows where it is, so it doesn't matter. Now, admittedly, the new system generated a lot of complaints from individuals in Ireland who didn't want to have to memorize a new address or an address at all in the first place. But it was balanced out by the massive love they got from businesses, both large and small, who soon discovered how much faster and cheaper it was now to deliver their products. And there is no reason that we couldn't also do this in the United States, other than the fact that people would definitely just refuse and our post office isn't brave enough to just throw our packages back at us and go, no, put the right numbers on there, you weakling. Next link.
Next link.
From New Scientist, we've got a little physics tidbit about the 100-year-old symmetry theorem that is still changing physics today. Now, specifically, I'm going to drop a name that I hope you remember. And chances are you have probably never heard of Emmy Noether.
Nope.
But you should have, because in her obituary that ran in the New York Times in 1935, no less than Albert Einstein wrote, in the judgment of the most competent living mathematicians, Fraulein Noether was the most significant creative mathematical genius thus far produced since the higher education of women began. Okay, we're going to pretend like the last sentence was just part and parcel of history, right? Because But that's quite the testimonial, right?
Yeah.
And what garnered that kind of admiration? Well, Noether was born in 1882, became one of the first women in the German-speaking world permitted to study at a university. But, of course, there was no prospect of her becoming a lecturer after graduating because women. And by 1916, she was officially an assistant to David Hilbert, a mathematics professor at Göttingen University. This meant that she was teaching the courses listed on the curriculum in his name, but without any contribution from him or any salary.
Oh,
but she also studied mathematical problems, and this is where she came to Einstein's attention. So at this time, Hilbert and his colleague Felix Klein found a difficulty with Einstein's, at the time, brand new general theory of relativity. Now, that's because the way Einstein had presented his equations included an expression that could be interpreted as implying conservation of energy, but which Hilbert and Klein pointed out was equivalent to saying x minus x equals zero, which, while true, doesn't tell us anything about x.
Mm-hmm.
So it was Noether who proved that energy must be conserved in any theory if the laws of physics stay the same no matter what time it is. In other words, if they are time invariant. So this was a pretty big deal, such that Einstein wrote to Hilbert saying, "Yesterday I received from Miss Noether a very interesting paper on invariant forms. I'm impressed that no one can comprehend these matters from so general a viewpoint." But Noether didn't stop there, because time invariance is a form of mathematical symmetry, because the rules are the same wherever you are in time. So get your visualization caps on here. If you take a square, rotate it by 90 degrees, it looks the same. This is one kind of symmetry. But if you rotate the square by 45 degrees, it looks different, like a diamond.
Mm-hmm.
This is called discrete symmetry because you have to go in discontinuous steps to restore the original appearance. But the contrast, if you have a circle, you can rotate it through any angle you like and it still looks the same. And that is called continuous symmetry. So what has become known as Noether's theorem, at least you got the name on the theorem there, it proves that in nature, the existence of any continuous symmetry is always linked with a conservation law. So you can use the symmetry to work out the conservation law, or you can use the conservation law to reveal the underlying symmetry. Now, there are some simple examples that highlight the power of this discovery. Think of the friend of all physics teachers, a hockey puck sliding over a frictionless surface. Now, if the moving puck gives a stationary puck a blow, the two pucks will slide off in different directions, sharing the momentum of the original puck. But the total momentum stays the same. So the fact that momentum is conserved in this process turned out to be linked to a continuous symmetry of space, which says that the puck moves in the same sort of way, meaning it obeys Newton's laws of motion, wherever it is on the icy surface. And the way that angular momentum is conserved, think of a spinning ice skater that spins faster when they tuck in their arms, that is linked to a continuous rotational symmetry. And what that says is if I do an experiment on a lab bench and then turn the bench by an arbitrary amount and repeat the experiment, I will get the same result.
Okay, yeah.
It says that if I do an experiment on Tuesday and repeat it on Thursday or any time because the symmetry is continuous, I will get the same result. Because that was the time invariance that got Noether started on all of this. It itself is a symmetry. So for her efforts, well, she was even given the honorary title of associate professor in 1922. Good on you, fellows.
Yeah, but was she paid?
No, no, still okay, no salary. Yeah. But she eventually did get a paid position. Doesn't really mention what the position was or when she got it, but she eventually got there. But, you know, the best theories make predictions about the behavior of things that were not previously understood. And by that measure, Noether's theorem has passed with flying colors. And it does get into quantum a little bit here, which is where it starts getting really exciting. This connection can be applied in the investigation of particles and fields at the quantum level. So when physicists find particles that behave in accordance with a particular symmetry, they can use that symmetry to predict the existence of other particles in the same family. This is one of the tools the theorists use to predict the existence of families of particles. And we're talking quarks, the Higgs boson, fundamental quantum particles, right? So even 100 years after Noether published her work, it is still at the edge of theoretical physics.
I mean, it makes sense now that Einstein would praise her because she basically made everybody stop saying he was wrong. Like, she backed him up. So he's like, hell yeah, I like this
she
lady.
She backed him up and was able to, like, extract one of his sort of little tidbits into something far more general and mm-hmm. encompassing in a way that I hope this also kind of moved the needle as far as, like, well, maybe there are smart women we should listen to because, boy, she sure came up with something. We'll see. That still seems to be in debate today.
I mean, at least they pay us right
for now.
Yeah.
Okay, next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from The Guardian. It's titled, Scientists Crack What They Say Is the Perfect Way to Boil an Egg.
Such a British headline, by the way. Like,
yes.
Americans do not care. And Britain's like, no, it matters.
Well,
this is important.
You know, with the price of eggs, it may matter. You want to make sure that you boil it right the first time.
Right. Don't ruin one.
Yeah. I mean, quite frankly, I don't think I'll ever do what they're describing in the article, but it sounds pretty cool. It's not that difficult, just time consuming. So Delia Smith demands 1 minute of simmering plus 6 of standing with the pan lid on. Heston Blumenthal brings his to the boil from cold. Now, scientists have weighed in on the perfect way to boil an egg, and the results are egg-streamly tasty. That's actually in the article. Had to keep that one. From a materials perspective, cooking an egg within its shell is more complicated than it might at first seem. Chefs are challenged by the fact that an egg's components, yolk and white, are made of different proteins that denature and thicken at different temperatures. Mm-hmm. 85 Celsius, 185 Fahrenheit for the white, and 65 Celsius or 149 Fahrenheit for the yolk. Because of this, the white and outer sphere of yolk are often overcooked, while the center might be undone. In 2002, the French molecular gastronomist Hervé This proposed an alternative solution. Cooking the egg in a water bath at 65 degrees Celsius for at least an hour. This sous vide method imbues the yolk with what he claims is an unparalleled flavor and texture. However, it also means the white does not fully set. The new approach, known as periodic cooking, was inspired by a technique previously developed to create layers within plastic objects. Ernesto Di Maio, a materials scientist at the University of Naples' Federico II, whose lab invented it, said, "It enables us to have one material in one piece, but with different structures and therefore different properties." It was a friend who suggested he try applying it to food. Di Maio says, "After all, our famous superstar chef in Italy, Carlo Cracco, sells eggs for 80 euros each."
Oh my God.
What?
Yeah. And so, you know, I guess if they can sell an egg for 80 euros, we can spend an hour on an egg. So his PhD student, Emilia Di Lorenzo, mathematically modeled the transfer of energy through the different layers of an egg, plus their cooking dynamics to come up with a basic method. She then refined it using computational fluid dynamics software. The technique involves alternating an egg between a pan of boiling water kept at 100 Celsius and a bowl kept at 30 Celsius every 2 minutes for 32 minutes.
What?
Or 8 cycles in total. So not an hour, but, you know, half an hour where you have to do something every 2 minutes. So by interrupting the transfer of heat from shell to center, the yolk's temperature never rises above 65 Celsius. It only reaches a gel-like state, says Di Lorenzo. Mm-hmm. And this research was published in Communications Engineering, which I'm not sure why. But that's where you can find it. There's a link in the article. The author of this particular article, Linda Geddes, actually tried the method. And there's some fun photos of her looking a little deranged as she's trying to juggle multiple things at once. I mean, she's making a wacky face. It's fun. And so she borrowed an aquarium heater from her son's fish tank to set up the 30 Celsius water bath. But every time she reintroduced the hot eggs, the temperature rose.
I'm sorry, the fish were just without a heater while she was doing her obsessive compulsive egg cooking?
I guess so. I mean, it was only 30 minutes, right?
Eggs are important, you guys. We have to make this matter.
Yeah. So the temperature rising meant that she needed to reset the stopwatch, quickly add some additional cold water, and keep a record of how many transfers she'd done, all before the next 2 minute timer went off, and then transfer the eggs back into the pan without dropping any. And as time went on, she grew increasingly skeptical. How on earth was the yolk going to remain soft when her eggs had spent a total of 16 minutes in boiling water? But the science won out. Her first attempt was, in fact, too liquid, which DeMaio attributed to using too large an egg. He suggested, we base these calculations on a 68-gram egg. If your egg is much larger, you should increase the cooking time by about 20 seconds each cycle.
Wow.
Yeah. On her second attempt, Linda cracked it. The white was gelatinous, the yolk a gel-like liquid. And compared with a control egg cooked the Delia way, the periodic yolk was creamier with a greater depth of flavor.
Okay, that sounds kind of worth it. Kind of.
Yeah, I mean, I might try it once. I don't have an aquarium or an aquarium water heater, but
right.
I'm sure I could find a way. So DiLorenzo has also used nuclear magnetic resonance and high-resolution mass spectrometry to analyze the nutritional composition of periodic eggs against sous vide and soft-boiled ones. Doing so suggested that the periodically cooked eggs contained more polyphenols, micronutrients with purported health benefits. DeMaio says he now boils all his eggs this way, and his friends and family thank him for it. Of course, it takes time, but I think it's good to dedicate some time for the people you love, he said. And Linda Geddes asked DiLorenzo if she feels the same way, and she paused, looked a little sheepish, and said, I don't really like eggs.
Especially after this.
Yeah.
That's perfect.
True scientist.
I promise her son hates them and will refuse to eat them for his entire life now after this. Mm-hmm.
It's like, I just like them scrambled.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Easy.
There's no need for any of this nonsense.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include... Origami-inspired floor design cuts concrete and steel use by half. Whale song shows hallmarks of human language. And 14.6-million-year-old bee fossil found in New Zealand. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on DamnInteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/DamnInteristingWeek. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.